This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Police continue to search for additional suspects in the murders of three young people in Newark, New Jersey last week. You've probably heard about how four college students were shot in the head after they were forced to kneel next to a wall in a schoolyard. One victim survived. For most of us, violence on that scale is something we see on television. In too many communities across the country, though, people live it. They learn to go to sleep despite the sound of gunfire and take precautions against the all-too-real possibility of a stray bullet. What effect does that have on people and on their neighborhoods? Today, living with murder. Later in the program, movies for captive audiences are on the opinion page this week. Columnist Pat Morrison collected a speeding ticket and was sentenced to watch a six-hour film on driving safety, and she has a review. But first, living with murder. If living with the threat of violence describes your life, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Valencia Muhammad, who founded Mothers of Unsolved Murders DC after her two sons were killed. She's also a reporter for the Afro-American newspaper here in Washington. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And we don't know exactly what happened in that schoolyard, but I wonder, what did you think about when you heard the news from Newark?
I was thinking that they had so many people around, hopefully somebody would come forth and give information so that the culprits could be arrested. Mm-hmm. And then knowing how scared people are, I was thinking, and especially because they had a victim, would they protect the victim in the hospital? And was that victim, after they were well, able to tell exactly what happens, if just in case they knew the culprit, so that they can be arrested? There's mm-hmm. a lot of things that go on your mind, but as a parent who has suffered from two murders, even the first one, it doesn't even matter. It's like you sit there and you just know what those parents are feeling. Mm-hmm. You know exactly what they're going through and what they will be going through in the future.
Mm-hmm. You're particularly concerned with unsolved murders, and your son's cases have yet to be solved.
Well, I have one that is what they call closed as far as the police department is concerned, but it's almost been 2 years now, and we still have yet to go to trial. So, in fact, I was supposed to go on August 7th, and then there was another continuum until October 1st, and so it just seems to go on and on and on. So and a lot of things come into play because once you're in the court system, if it takes a long time before it actually comes forth, you might lose a witness. I mean, mm-hmm. meaning the person might leave town,
yeah.
or leave the country, or they might be sick, or they might die. You know, like, God forbid. There's a lot of things, you know, on both sides that might happen. They may lose some evidence. So you get really, you're really praying a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in all of that time, you just showed me a copy of your newspaper, an insert from the newspaper, and you had, what, 8 pages of pictures mm-hmm. of people who have been murdered in Washington, D.C. in 1 year whose cases are unsolved.
Right. Many of those cases still remain unsolved.
And these are terrifyingly young, most of them.
Most of them.
And you just look at their pictures, and they're all walks of life. They're from all kinds of different places.
Yes.
And the one thing they have in common is that they were all murdered.
Due to gunfire, primarily.
As you live in this community where this becomes a daily occurrence, well, you specialize in it, but...
Well, I can tell
everybody
you,
knows somebody.
Everybody knows somebody. That is the truth. It really affects your health. Like a lot of the mothers have had heart attacks, strokes. Some of them have checked themselves into mental institutions. Some of them have sedated themselves with alcohol and drugs. We've had families where the husband and wife have a divorce. That's common.
Mm-hmm.
Each one's blaming each other for that moment. You know, maybe one told him to go. The child to go here and he went somewhere else, or the mother was more loving, the father was more demanding, all kinds of stuff, so they blame each other. There's a lot of things. People curse God. There's a lot of things going on. Some people become obese. I've seen people become very fragile and stop eating and starve themselves. People don't know. And we've had even some of the siblings, to their minds to snap, and they've actually had to go and for long periods of time into mental institutions.
Your two sons, they had siblings too, your other children. How are they doing?
Not well. Not well at all. Two of my sons just refuse to come back to the District of Columbia, and if they do, it's only for a brief moment. One is getting ready to graduate at North Carolina Central. He's done absolutely well, been on the dean's list. But he says, just, Ma, I don't want to be there. Just to, those memories are too much for me. And then the other, he was an older son. He's established himself there. He's a homeowner. He's doing well. And he just says, I know too many people who've passed in like the last 10 years, and I would just prefer if I stayed away. Had a daughter who turned to alcohol. Don't forget, she's growing up in a house. We never smoked cigarettes, never had alcohol, that kind of stuff. And then one daughter's mind snapped. So it's like an ongoing saga.
Mm-hmm. And if this becomes, you know, the numbers of killings in this city is, we're talking about Washington, D.C., where this program is based, where you live. The gun, you must jump at the sound of a gunfire.
At the sound of a gunfire. No, you don't. No, you've almost become conditioned to that. Sometimes you're jumping when you're at the stoplight because you don't know whether or not somebody's going to shoot you because they're an aggressive driver, and maybe you beep the horn. That kind, and people have been shot and killed just for something as simple as that. I don't know. It has you on very tense all the time.
Hmm.
It's nerve-wracking.
I suspect it is. There are so many cop programs on TV, you know, Law and Order and CSI. Can you watch those?
Oh, I'm a CSI girl.
Yeah?
All the way. Law and Order. Those are my real movies, the sitcoms, whatever. I just stay glued to those. And I'm running in the house, I'm trying to find one of those because they are about the business of solving crimes and taking people to court for those crimes.
And
they're the favorites of many of the other mothers that I've talked to.
Because in most of those, a vast majority of them, they find out who did it and they pay the price.
Right. And they are diligently trying to uncover the truth. They're not making up stuff. I may be too much television watching, but I like it. For instance, the CSI has brought it to our attention and helped us in terms of our fortitude to push forward for a forensics lab here in the District of Columbia. Most people have no knowledge of the fact that in the nation's capital, we don't have our own forensics lab. So if a young lady, tourist visiting or whatever, were to get raped, she would, her case, you know, her specimen would just go on the side in some closet somewhere. Mm. So we're trying to push forward for that, and we need all of the assistance from everyone from around the United States.
Our guest is Valencia Muhammad, founder of Mothers of Unsolved Murders, D.C. We're talking today about living with murder. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Blake joins us now on the line. Blake is calling us from Oakland, California.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling from Oakland. And I currently live about 5.5 blocks from where Chauncey Bailey was slain, basically.
That's the editor who was killed, last week as well?
Yeah, I mean, 5 blocks. Now, that area, well, where I live, is fantastic. But you go right around the corner, not a block and a half, mayhem. It's unbelievable. And it will never reach around the bend. Maybe around Christmas time, when they're really hungry for money. But I digress. It's a condition you meet in your mind. It's you almost have to carry, you not almost, you have to carry yourself a certain way, even a certain look on your face, a certain manner of walk and smile. You must keep it constantly. Even though it's not you, you may be even a Bible-toting Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have an outer armor, an attitude, and a whole set of rules, different rules you live by. Those rules drop off when you get to the job, of course. But
mm-hmm. Yeah. Valencia Muhammad, I see you nodding your head as Blake is talking.
He's exactly right, because when you have, especially in the particular cases that I'm speaking of, when you have so many, you have almost 4,000 unsolved murders in the districts on the books since 1969. Now, some of those people have come and gone. Some of them are dead and they've never been prosecuted. But just the fact of the matter is, just knowing that they got away with murder, so to me, it's like gives other people the incentive to go out there and kill anybody you want. Nobody's going to really do anything. So yeah. because of that that attitude out there, he's right. He don't know which way to look. I mean, I don't know. You know, just, whoa. All we're just knowing is somebody's out there who's committed a crime that has never been prosecuted. We don't know who that person is. So you got to walk this tightrope at all times.
Yeah, it's almost an innate survival that kicks in. I swear, I work in an area that those things are absolutely unheard of. And I feel so much better out here when I work when I work in that particular area. But you can almost feel a spirit of it as you enter into your town or your neighborhood where you actually live. You feel it's almost sick, something you can feel, and it's an innate survival mechanism that you need. It's imperative for just to live, not to pay your bills. No, to live life. Actual life, to keep your life. It's unbelievable. You can't look in certain directions or even dress a certain way. I'm not talking the gang colors. I'm talking if I come home in my little work outfit, khaki polo shirt, even that is looked upon as, you know what, this guy's an outsider. We don't like the way he's just too clean cut. We can take him out, just get him out of the way, no matter what, if he's if he's undercover or not. It's unbelievable. I'm a professional. I work in the medical field, and I have to dress and carry myself a certain way.
Sure.
A normal, gentlemanly way.
We just have a few seconds before we have to go to a break, but Valencia, you were going to say something?
I was going to say, just recently, one of my friends is a Capitol Hill police officer, and he lives on Capitol Hill. And he was riding his bike in the afternoon, you know, so he's always armed, but it was a concealed weapon. And he was riding his bike. This person came up to him at gunpoint, took the bike, came back on gunpoint, took the helmet, came back, and again, and he's walking towards his house, and we thought maybe he was going to kill him or take his money, and then he had to pull the gun out and shoot him.
More on Living with Murder. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Too many neighborhoods have become accustomed to constant violence, even death. Today we're talking about the toll that takes. What's it like to live day by day with murder? Our guest is Valencia Muhammad. She founded Mothers of Unsolved Murders, D.C., after her two sons were killed. And, of course, if this describes how you live, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Brian. Brian's with us from East Oakland in California. Another call from Oakland.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to echo the sentiments of the previous Oakland caller,
Blake,
and also extend my condolences to your guest.
I
was kind of downwardly mobile. I lived in on the peninsula in San Francisco. I went through a divorce and all of that entails, and was remarried. And now I found myself living really on the edge of what I would have considered a war zone. 10 years ago, I heard probably three of the murders that were nationally publicized, the 8 murders last weekend, just with the gunshots. You'll hear 5 rattled off in a moment. And I just wanted to echo her comments about prayer. A number of years ago, when Oakland was experiencing a real peak, Reverend Jackson at a local evangelical church, revivalist sort of church, had a prayer vigil, and for an entire month, we did not have one murder. We should have had 15. And whether that was divine intervention or whether that was just people caring and keeping their eyes open, I think it kind of falls back to the fact that we're all neighbors and that we all have to keep an eye out for each other and each other's children. I'd just like to make that point to her and, again, extend my feelings on your guest's grief.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian, just let me ask, you said you heard the shots that killed these people. What is it like to realize afterwards, the next day, whenever, that those sounds you heard in the night, those were not just random sounds, that was the sound of death?
Well, I wasn't nearly as prayerful as I have become lately, but I have to take a moment when I hear that and pray. And I have a 6-year-old son who's growing up in this, and we're not really in the middle of it, but we're close enough to it that we bear, you know, witness. And he asks about it now, and it's hard to explain to him.
Yeah.
That these are people that, you know, in a moment when they're not themselves, they become monsters. And in any other given moment, they might, you know, be perfectly decent people under a slightly different circumstance. And at that moment, they're almost possessed. And that's the only way you can really, you can't really even explain that to a 6-year-old. But
yeah. Well, we wish you the best of luck keeping your son safe.
Thank you.
For me, when I hear shots like that, first of all, I'm feeling them almost. It's like it's penetrating my body. And secondly, sometimes I'm looking out the window or hoping that someone will just give me information so that I can help the police department solve that murder. You know, I want it to stop.
Brian, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Joining us now is Deborah Prothro-Stith. She's professor of public health practice at Harvard School of Public Health, and she joins us today from our member station in Boston, WBUR. Nice to have you on the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Neil.
And I know you've been listening to Valencia's story. What are some of the ways that friends and families of a murder victim can be affected when this is, I mean, we all know, of course, it's grief, individual grief, but what happens when this is cumulative?
Well, first of all, Neil, I just thank you for paying attention to this issue. We've been working with survivors of homicide families and siblings for about 15 years now. And a lot of what we need to know to be helpful has still not been learned. And just this kind of attention to the issue, I think, helps the professional community as well as the families themselves deal with this. And also Ms. Muhammad's courage just for what she's doing, I just want to appreciate.
Okay.
What you've heard is really very similar and very typical. It's actually a syndrome that we're learning more about, similar to post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD is the diagnosis that is given after a war when veterans come home, but it's been expanded to include those traumatic situations that people survive. And in the case of families who've experienced the murder of a loved one, particularly for the younger children, we're finding the similarities. Now, it's not always post-traumatic in the sense that veterans have come home from war, and the war is over for them in a physical sense. But many of these families, and particularly the siblings, are living with ongoing episodes of violence. So
right.
While it's similar, it's not quite the same. So we've got a lot to learn about the symptoms, the sleeplessness, the nightmares, the anxiety attacks, the constant replay of the episodes, the hyper fear. All of those are symptoms that we're seeing. And what you've heard from Ms. Muhammad and the callers is very similar to what we've seen with other families.
Regrettably, murder is not the only crime that's in the human experience. Is there something, though, different about murder as compared to armed robbery or even rape?
I think there are some differences. Again, we have a lot more that we need to learn. And in some ways, families that have experienced a suicide have a lot to teach in this situation. But what's pretty clear about the situation with murder is the finality of it and the need for a family not just to heal, but to figure out how to move forward without this person. And that's often very difficult, particularly during the holidays or doing family vacations and rituals. It leaves a hole and a gap. And people are expected to go back to work within a week. siblings are expected to go back to school, and the human service and health community has not adequately trained on how to provide the right services. We really need the voices of these victims, really, the surviving family members to help us even know what to do and what's helpful.
Mm-hmm. It just occurred to me as she was speaking, Valencia Muhammad, that Christmas or Thanksgiving has got a whole different meaning to you.
Well, I'm Muslim, so the Christmas thing I can put out, but the birthdays,
sure,
yes,
and then you got to remember the death day. I mean, that's big time in our with parents of murdered victims or survivors, and then just everybody else's birthday in the family, and then one of your children has a child, and you were wondering if they had children, what it was going to be like. And then sometimes you got mothers that are survivors of homicide that are raising the children of the deceased. It just seems to go on. It's like a never-ending battle. And then you go to the next generation. So now I've got my grandchildren. And now all of a sudden I see one of them that gives me raises the eyebrow or doesn't say, answer me in the manner that I like. And I say, well, that kind of like reminded me of my second son who got killed. So let me just straighten that out real quick.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going that way. I'm not burying any more of my people, so get your act together now. It's just like it can just go on and on and on.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Carol. Carol's with us from Golconda in Illinois.
Hi. I've just retired from many years of teaching at a federal Job Corps program.
Mm-hmm.
Although I live in a rural area, many of my students were from Chicago, Detroit, and some of the large Midwestern cities. And one of the things I always feared was when they went home for holidays, because I thought maybe I wouldn't see them again. And I had one student, Cornelius Davis. I don't know if I can do this without crying, so bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
Cornelius was 17. He was ready to take his GED, which is what I taught. And he wrote me this poem before he went home, and I saved it. The title is "When Will It All End?" Shots being fired on the block. Homies being shot, innocent body being dropped. We used to go halves on penny cookies on the block, bubble gum, icy cups, freeze pops on the block. Going halves on a shooting because it's war on the block. If you check the history of most clubbers on the block, they used to be smart. Now they burned out, turned out, strung out, ready to rob on the block. And he went home for Christmas and was sitting in a car outside his house, and someone opened the door and shot him in the head with a shotgun.
I'm not trying to justify what happened to that young man, but a lot of times what we've seen is that parents place their kids in situations like the Job Corps, or they put them outside the community in programs because they fear for them their lives. And all of a sudden, whatever kind of wrongdoing or whatever they may have been involved in, they may have even seen something but didn't tell anybody. They make themselves vulnerable when they come back into the communities.
That was exactly what happened to Cornelius.
See?
Yeah. Carol, I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
And thanks very much for the call.
Uh-huh.
All right. Bye-bye. The word pathology, Deborah Prothro-Stith, that seems to come up in my mind. I mean, there's so many layers of this, each reinforcing the other. If you know something about this, you become scared of those people whom this just grows and grows. It metastasizes.
The thing about this problem that we have in the United States, which is pretty unique among industrialized countries, is that it does feed on itself. There's a cycle to it. And once you focus in on the violence and the fear that it breeds, you wind up seemingly inadvertently creating more violence. People stay in their homes and lock the doors, which creates isolated spaces in the community that are not thriving with life and people, and are prime places for bad things to happen. People start getting guns thinking they're going to protect themselves, and those guns often get used in crime and other episodes of violence. It kind of feeds on itself in a very frightening way. I wish we had some comparable television shows to CSI that really focused in on the prevention that we know works. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a murder prevention series or something. I'm thinking, you know, we know that mentoring programs like Big Brother, Big Sister really work. We know that violence prevention education in schools for all children can reduce the number of fightings and violent episodes in the school. We know that taking care of children at the infancy age really matters when it comes to school performance. And so I wish we could turn our murder prevention activities toward the true prevention activities, because that's where we can stop this cycle. Otherwise, we just continually feed on the violence, and it does continue to get worse.
That's Deborah Prothro-Stith, who's with the Harvard School of Public Health. Also with us, Valencia Muhammad, founder of Mothers of Unsolved Murders, D.C. She's also a reporter for the Afro-American newspaper. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Graham. Graham's with us from Rochester, New York.
Hi, and I appreciate this topic. It's good to talk to you about it. I live in a very high crime area. Just a couple weeks ago, someone was shot several times within 100 feet of my house. There have been numerous murders and assaults in this section of Rochester, which is the southwest section of Rochester. I think it's important to bring all this into perspective, though. About a year ago, I worked in Sweden for several months, and I would ask people when I got there, you know, is this a good neighborhood? Is this a bad neighborhood? And people would laugh at me, and they'd say, "Oh, you're in Stockholm. There are no bad neighborhoods. I mean, there are lower income areas and higher income areas." But what I found to be true is that there really weren't any places that were more or less safe. They were all incredibly safe, and I realized that was due in part to Sweden's high investment in education and in other basic services. And, in our country, where we spend about 50% of our federal budget on the military, and we're very permissive with regard to handguns, even areas that are very restrictive with regard to handguns. Someone can go to another area, purchase a gun, and bring it in. Mm. I think that it's important to look at this in a larger framework, and as a society, we care much more, or we care much less about protecting people from violence than we do about maintaining a strong military. And I think if we invested more in education and services, we'd be in a much better spot. So I'd like to.
Well, I also have some friends of mine who
Valencia
live in
Muhammad.
Sweden.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Graham, I also have some friends of mine who live in Sweden. Their mother is Swedish and their father is African American, and they have dual citizenship. And one of the things that they told me is they don't worry about housing. They're not worried about jobs. So here, you know, like those are some of the main issues why people commit some of the crimes that they do, because you know they're beating somebody on top of the head because they want some food to eat, or they don't have housing. They're seeing other people with riches and they don't have different things. In Sweden, that's not this particular situation, and I have constant discussions with them on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. When they turn like 15, 16, the government automatically gives them an apartment. We don't have that kind of situation over here. We got $450,000 condominiums and $500,000 homes now in the district, and we have a lot of people sitting on the sideline watching all this economic development, and they're just and they don't have any jobs.
Hmm. Let me ask you, Deborah Prothro-Stith. There are other differences between the United States and Sweden too. A much more homogenized society in Sweden,
right? It's very hard to compare countries because you've got those differences—not just gun availability and investment in school and alcohol consumption, culture, number of hours of television watched by children. You could make a list of about 40 things. But what it does point out, I think, is that we're dealing with a problem. problem we don't have to have. We're dealing with a preventable problem. When you compare the United States murder rates to other industrialized countries, you come up with something that's 5 times to 70 times higher than other countries to which we usually compare ourselves. And that says to me that we've got a preventable problem. This isn't an inevitable problem. These children are not born murderers. In many ways, we have to focus on the prevention aspects of it. What is it in investing in education, investing in healthcare, investing in our children that we are not doing that we need to do? How is it that we help those children who witness violence in homes and in their communities really learn to heal and deal from with that fear and that grief and that anger and that extra pain that they have? There's a curriculum peace zone, which begins in the elementary schools to help kids deal with that. Children Witness to Murder Project at Boston Medical Center, another way that people have some resources. So we've got to focus on prevention.
Deborah Prothro-Stith, thank you so much for your time
today.
We appreciate it. She's a professor of public health practice at the Harvard School of Public Health. With us today from member station WBUR in Boston. Valencia Muhammad was with us here in Studio 3A. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, sir.
And when we come back on the opinion page, we've got the movie of the summer. It's The Talk of the Nation from NPR News.